Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. On today's episode, I interview Dr. Michael Mance. He's a psychiatrist practicing in Santa Barbara, California, and one of his specialties is ketamine therapy. I invited Dr. Mance to come on the podcast to talk about ketamine, its uses, how it helps people, and what to expect if you decide you want to. Ketamine is a way of treating some depression, anxiety, and other issues. Again, I think you'll find this conversation quite fascinating. Dr. Mance is very knowledgeable about the field of ketamine therapy, and I look forward to this chat with him. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Michael Mance into my office. He is a psychiatrist in Santa Barbara, and one of his specialties is ketamine therapy, which I think is a really, really important topic for us to discuss. And I'm really looking forward to your perspective, Michael. I think it's I've heard really good things about you. It's a pleasure to meet you. And I always love to start off the podcast by asking my guests to describe who they are, and so we get a general idea of what your life looks like.
Okay, that's a pretty broad statement.
I realize.
Please curtail me. I could go off into tangents that you may not want. So, who I am? I mean, spiritually. No, I'm just kidding on that one.
Well, you can talk about anything you like. It's fine. Everybody should know what what you bring to the table.
I think I would put myself as an atypical psychiatrist, even a medical doctor, because I had a very circuitous route to getting here. I'd always had an interest in health and well-being throughout my entire life, mainly because I had a lot of illnesses early on in my life, little different issues. I mean, by age 16, I was having an endoscopy and a colonoscopy, and had various issues with my gut, and I was actually overall I would have a lot of different pains and issues, and I'm not going to go through all the specifics, but eventually I was on 3 medications by age 17. I was on a PPI, Prevacid. I was on something else for my gut, and another medicine as well, and increasingly feeling more and more uncomfortable within my own skin. And so just accelerating that through, by age 20, 21, I was at 270 pounds essentially.
Wow.
Currently right now I'm 205.
Yeah. You look quite thin to me.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a big weight loss.
It took me eventually about 2.5-3 years to do so. Then once I found my natural weight, which is what my weight is now, when that happened, I was able to get rid of all my medications, all that stuff went away. And actually that part went away pretty early. Just cutting out for me was dairy and soda, and no doctor had told me about this.
Really?
So, and then I became very much more disenfranchised, going to a lot of doctors for a lot of different issues, and then just making some simple lifestyle corrections. It was just like flabbergasted that I had to go through all that pain and suffering, and just some basic understanding of lifestyle would have been so helpful that I got very interested in nutrition and exercise, lifestyle, all that stuff. And bringing it back around, I eventually went through, I decided maybe to go explore these other alternative lifestyle healing modalities. And I would go into, whether it was meditation, whether it's exercise, I became a physical, a personal trainer at the gym. I then went to herbal school, and I did a home correspondence school, which then ended where I do 2 weeks in the it was one of the best experiences to finalize my master's in herbal medicine, which is up in Utah, up in the mountains. So really learning all these different healing traditions. And then I explored Chinese traditional medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, and I started helping people. And it was really, really nice to be able to do so. Though there was a part where a lot of times people say, yeah, but you're not a doctor.
Right.
Well, you can't do this or you can't do that. And I didn't like being curtailed like that. And I did have an interest always in science and reading clinical stuff. And that seemed to come natural to me. A bit of a nerd like that. You would see me in, as a teenager, instead of going out, I'd go to the Barnes and Nobles and you'd see me reading books. So I was just fascinated at whether to cure myself or help myself or to help others.
Yeah.
So that's how it kind of born out of that. So then I went back to, school and went to medical school at 26, 27.
Okay.
And, you know, was mainly always an outsider in that, because I was always promoting lifestyle and people would actually make fun of me when I bring in like my bell peppers and other things like that to say, why are you eating like a rabbit for it? What, you think that's going to help you? And that kind of stuff. So
so you went to a traditional medical school, obviously.
I did. I went to the University of Pittsburgh medical school over there. And so then I went through that. And just a long story short, you could always dive in if you wanted to. But when you go to medical school, it's like you're drinking through a fire hose of information being shot at you.
Right.
So you really, it's really nice actually to buy into the drink the Kool-Aid and buy into everything they're saying.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I was already on the other side, more or less. So
it
you're
was too late for them to get to you.
Correct. And so the level of cognitive dissonance that I experienced was so tremendous that, and I hadn't recognized that at the time, that I actually had ADHD and I wasn't diagnosed with that. So I wound up gravitating towards taking herbs that were stimulating to the system.
Right.
And I wound up overdoing it. And I started getting a heart issue started to come up. And then when I was studying for my step one of my boards, I went through like the level of intensity just overwhelmed the system. And I was over exercising to try to regulate my anxiety. And eventually I wound up developing what's called a dysautonomia called POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardic syndrome. I know that's a mouthful, and it knocked me out for 16 months. I almost never got back into medical school. And so it took me, and at that time I had gone too far on the other side where Western medicine was sort of taught in these other schools as being like poison, toxic. If you take anything, you're screwed. So I was on that side. And so it took me 7 months of just, I literally couldn't walk after a while. That's how bad the symptoms got. But I refused medicine under the belief that I would actually, if I took it, I was never going to get better. But eventually that wound up, the crushing anxiety turned into my first major depression episode that I ever had. And I couldn't function at all. And so eventually my brother convinced me, actually, at the very end when I'm just in tears all the time, you got to try something. Right. So I went on a beta blocker and an antidepressant, and I thought I was going to die. But they did help, but it wasn't them alone. I did that, and then I also did acupuncture. I went to psychotherapy. So the whole journey took me through a very integrative approach, using both Western and these other, I wouldn't say alternative, but I would just say more lifestyle-based healing modalities. And through my own healing journey, I was able to get back into medical school, graduate. And I was going to be a family physician at that time, but, you know, going through several psychiatrists at the time and receiving really what I thought was like terrible care, to be quite honest with you, that I felt so like abandoned by how they treated me, that I felt really compelled that psychiatry really needed another way of being treated. And I felt very much called to that. So I shifted my specialty to going into psychiatry. And that's what brought me into that. I've always had a fascination with the mind. And that's kind of what then brought me into psychiatry and then following and so on and so forth. So I'll leave it at that.
I think that's really fascinating, actually. So you did is it a residency that you did in psychiatry?
Yes.
And where?
At the University of California in Irvine.
Oh, okay. So here in California.
Correct. Yep.
Is that what brought you to California, or did you come from here originally?
No, I actually grew up in New Jersey for the first 30 years of my life, essentially, except for going to Pittsburgh during my training.
Okay.
And I came out here, little after I went to medical school, which is about maybe like 31, 32 years old. And then I came out here because have you ever been to Pittsburgh?
I'm laughing because I have a dear friend whose girlfriend lives there, and They don't speak very highly of it at all.
Well, it's not as bad as we might think about if you hadn't been there before. There is some beauty. They had a kind of a renaissance of sorts, but
right.
I love the sun. Yeah. And it's natural for me. And okay. So usually the clouds come in November and you don't see the sun again until like April.
Wow.
Seriously, if we think right now when we have our little May, June, you know, sort of gloom thing going on now, right. Times that by like about six, seven months.
Can't even imagine.
Yes. So I decided any residency was basically, I looked at South Carolina. I looked at Duke. I looked at anywhere where there's yeah. much more sun than where it was. So that brought me out here. And also, because of my integrative and spiritual kind of beliefs, generally there's a greater openness to that, as you go more west.
Yeah.
So that also brought me out here as well.
Yeah, when you're brought up in California, I've only gone to California schools. No other place in the United States actually exists. It's just an afterthought because it's a very self-centered state. So I can appreciate your desire to come looking for the sun.
Yes.
And so how did you end up then in Santa Barbara?
So, like, I met my wife at UC Irvine, and that's been my wife, Kim, and she was also a psychiatrist, and that also kept me here, you know, because I have all my family and friends are all there, in the East Coast. So I met my lovely wife, and then we were, we were just trying to explore where we would want to, like, maybe start a practice. We both had the same sort of integrative beliefs, and we both thought that maybe starting a private practice somewhere, and you know, it was more like we traveled up the coast and we're both very kinesthetic where we you can feel it in your gut, like what's coming up, what's helpful. Cause I've been fooled by my brain too many times. So I've learned to listen to my gut a lot more. And Santa Barbara kept coming up again and again. And there seemed to be even some synchronicity in that involved as well. And so over time we just said, yeah, I guess it's going to be Santa Barbara. And so we just decided to come here and here we are.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a bit about your practice, what it looks like and the kinds of issues that you deal with, people that you treat, and then we can get on to the subject of ketamine.
Sure. So I knew if I wanted to do an integrative model, unfortunately, like in the Western model with psychiatry, and this is an issue with my colleagues, is that if you take insurance or you're involved with any kind of official institution, the way that psychiatry is practiced in the United States, not a lot of countries actually practice it the way that we do. For instance, like in New Zealand, they may see like 3 or 4 patients, you know, in a day.
Really?
But when we're doing it, yeah, I know, it's like very different. UK is also less volume too. But in the United States, it's like if you go into private practice and you're taking insurance, you're expected, in order to even keep that practice running, you'll do like maybe a 45-minute intake and then 10-15 minute what we call a med check.
Right.
And of course that you're not going to be able to, I mean, anybody understands when you're trying to deal with emotions, especially sensitive ones, you're not even going to get that maybe until 20, 25 minutes, maybe 40 minutes into a conversation.
Right.
So how else are you going to do it? So it's almost set up for us to just medicate and change the medicines, but not really give us an opportunity to do any root level work. So I knew I needed to do an out of network business, which we created an out of network private practice, which takes time, as you know, because, you know, obviously people have to pay out of pocket in that way, but they could always get a super bill too if their insurance covers it. But I wanted to be able to do my integrative model where it wasn't just medication. Medication plays a role. It is a powerful tool when used appropriately, but I wanted to use all the things that I learned, you know, nutrition. I learned that from also Dr. Joel Fuhrman mentored me in that. He's a 6-time New York Times bestseller in nutrition, but also the exercise that I learned as a personal trainer, the herbal medicine, the supplements that I learned, how I used it with former clients when I was doing it before I went to medical school, but how to weave all of that together. And then my wife and I are also trained in about 4 different psychotherapies.
Oh, okay.
So learning how to weave that all, which is tricky. Because you don't want to do too much, but you want to make sure. But that took some time to kind of weave that in and learn how to navigate those spaces. But I wanted to have a practice that was open to that, where we could do most of my appointments, not including the ketamine appointments, are 50 minutes.
Okay.
And so that way we can actually have a relationship, and our intakes are 80 minutes. Right. So I wound up dealing with a full spectrum of clients. We wound up splitting it up a little bit because we have our own different complementarity strengths between my wife and I. So she will do more like the pure depressives and more of the trauma work. She has a lot of background in that, and that was something that called to her a lot. I tend to attract more of what I tend to have, and that is like I have an obsessive tendency. If I get stressed, I might have some OCD tendencies that will pop up. So I'll tend to get a lot of anxious clients. The depression that comes from chronic anxiety or exacerbated anxiety, as I will call it, anxiety over depression instead of depression over anxiety.
Right.
And then OCD. I've had some in the beginning. I was dealing more with also psychosis, schizophrenia, those kind of things, but. The more I practice now, it's more focused on more neurotic like conditions. And like, you know, like I said before, like OCD, substance abuse was also a big one for me. I had some, some of my close friends and also some of my sort of second, third degree relatives had struggled with that. So I had, I think I just had a natural calling and an understanding because a lot of times there's so much judgment that's in that field
yes.
that I naturally didn't have because I could see it from a deeper perspective. And so when you're trying to start a practice, you're trying to, build it up. So I worked at as a clinical director to a substance abuse clinic while I build up my practice. And then I implement all those together into an integrative model.
Okay. Are you in full-time practice at this point?
Yes. I would say I'm starting to scale back a little bit. I'm looking to actually, I'm more of a teacher at heart. Both my parents are teachers. Okay. And so I have that built into me. So I am looking to, but right now I still am full-time, but I'm looking to start to shorten those hours. And I'm also focusing more on my ketamine work.
Okay.
Because I just have found that to be so deeply rewarding to see people really get better so quickly and learning how to use that tool more effectively. So that really, I'm welcoming in still new ketamine patients, but I'm no longer accepting general psychiatric clients right now. My wife still does that a little bit, but I'm in that way.
So Michael, I know a little bit about ketamine as mm-hmm. a professional, but most of the time in my, personal world, when I mention the word, people have heard of it, but have no idea what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So would you mind starting like at a very basic level and telling us what ketamine is?
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
Then we'll go from there.
All right. Sounds great. So ketamine was first approved in 1970 as an anesthetic. We were really looking for different anesthetic medications. Some of them were pretty toxic. And so it was first synthesized in 1962, and then it was approved in 1970. And often it was one of the safest anesthetics that we ever had because most anesthetics will depress our respiratory function. And that can be a problem, obviously, and something that can be dangerous. But ketamine has an interesting effect. It doesn't cause this respiratory depression. And in fact, it causes maybe a mild stimulation of both the heart rate and the respiratory rate a little bit, which makes it much more safer than any of the other anesthetics that they use. So just a little interesting side effect. It became used, it was used in Vietnam War because oftentimes when soldiers would get injured, severely injured, they would have to use morphine and oftentimes they would get overdosed and die.
Right.
So it was called the buddy drug, ketamine, where they would go out and they would all be equipped with ketamine. And if someone got severely injured, they would inject them with the ketamine right then and there and allow them to feel pain relief without having to worry of having them maybe die in the process. So it had a really powerful helping effect in that regard. And they came pretty quickly to notice that it started also had some psychological benefits. The first study being conducted with ketamine for psychological was done in 1973, which is pretty interesting. And it started to gain some more prominence sort of unofficially in the psychotherapy as what they called a psychotherapy accelerant. And it became much more popular in the 70s and then in the 80s in that regard. But it became more also on the streets, it became more abused.
And so in the
abusive way, that kind of shut down a little bit of its use. And they started not using it as much for a while. Then around 2000, they started opening up new trials again, looking at ketamine and its effects. for psychological benefits. And by 2006, the National Institute of Health released a press release that is saying that, you know, one single dose of this medicine can create rapid antidepressant effects. Wow. And so that launched a whole new studying, all studies, and we started learning so much really interesting things about it. So, you know, so we started learning first that it could be a very powerful anti-suicidal drug. By like one, sometime infusion for like 2 hours could knock out the suicide in one treatment for about 7 days.
That's and then, miraculous.
Isn't that ridiculous? It was absolutely astounding. We had no other treatment that remotely touched powerful. Yeah. Exactly.
That's remarkable, actually.
It is. That alone is just remarkable. Now, it's short-lived. They would need to get a booster effect. They would have to go get another one another week. And so they were trying to figure out, do we use ketamine to kind of then, you know, then get them onto something else that usually takes a little more time, like an antidepressant, like 5 or 6 weeks later, and just use that as a bridge. But they found that sometimes they did that, but other times if they kept using it for a while and then increasing the interval of using it, that actually people would get better and not need any medicine at all.
And did they ever figure out why it was so short-lived at first?
Well, I think with anything, it has a pretty short half-life.
Oh, okay.
So it's going to be in, out of the body. Usually, if it's done IM, I believe the half-life is somewhere around 45 minutes.
Oh, it's
so
really quick.
It's out really fast, which has some benefits to it as well. It's one of the reasons why we can use it in office, unlike some of the other psychedelics, which may last like 5-6 hours.
Yeah.
It, you know, generally the acute effects will last about an hour, and then we're supposed to hold them for about 2 hours, and then we can let them go at that point. So it allows us to be able to use that. And so it was a great first entry into one of the first psychedelics, that ketamine. I put that in that category that we now use psychotherapeutically.
But it's an anesthetic. How do you qualify it in your mind as a psychedelic?
Yeah. So, well, this brings me back. I always reverse these names, correct me wrong, William James, the psychologist, yeah. You know, he was using, I believe, nitrous oxide
yeah. And
a lot of his things, having these visions and everything. And so that, again, is an anesthetic, but used at sub-anesthetic dosing.
Oh, okay.
Same thing here. When you use ketamine, and what we call low-dose ketamine and sub-anesthetic dosing. So what you're essentially doing is, you know, if we put you under ketamine therapy right now, I mean, I can inject you to a point where you go fully unconscious. Well, what if I gave you like a tenth of the dose? So you go into this twilight state.
Oh, okay.
So then your mind is actually able to access parts of your psychology, your unconscious, subconscious mind that you normally wouldn't have access to. So that's the beauty of it. And also, because you're in this sort of twilight state, you're also more suggestible. You're more open. You're less, and because it has this really interesting, what we call dissociative anesthetic, meaning it kind of creates a kind of separation of the felt sense of your own consciousness separating from one's body, that oftentimes a lot of the reasons why we're so defended against, say, different types of emotions are the adverse bodily sensations.
Right.
Now imagine we've turned that off for a moment. And now the emotion or something else comes up, and then the body sensations are now feeling like more comfortable, more soothed. Well, then it allows naturally these sort of, we get an opportunity of these defense mechanisms starting to melt away, allowing this sort of what we call, I mean, classically we might call an abreaction, where the person right. might relive an experience, but do so in a much more comfortable setting and have what we may call an emotional corrective experience, much more deeply done. And if it's held in the appropriate space, can be deeply transformative. But so going into this twilight state, the hypnagogic sort of imagery, that kind of stuff, often done, it's not like in other psychedelics, like say psilocybin, where you might see trails or something when your eyes are open. There's generally not much visual effects in that regard. But when you close your eyes, and oftentimes we do recommend that a person put an eye mask on, a lot of people will get very powerful visualizations underneath that, you know, when they're in that experience. Also, they might get a really like vivid memory of at 7 years old that they hadn't thought of in like years, and be able right. to describe it just like as if you got someone deeply in hypnosis.
Yeah, I was going to say it sounds very similar to the altered state of consciousness.
Like a regression hypnosis therapy, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting here thinking, wow, this is like a medical way of helping you get there really quickly.
Exactly.
And
that's
maybe
that's what I'm excited
more deeply
about.
In some ways, because sometimes the anxiety that you might have of, I mean, a lot of times when I say the word hypnosis to the first time to one of my clients, I see, you know, that everything gets tight.
Yes.
Because the misnomer about it, you know, that I'm going to send them home quacking like a duck. And that,
correct. They're going to mind control.
Right. So this would, I guess, in a way, all of that goes away very quickly because of the anesthetic quality of the medicine.
Yeah. And then now I know your knowledge with hypnotherapy, you could see how when you have a basically a trance augmentation agent that you can use and dial it in, how deep do you want to go? Like, that's really the precision that we have with
it's
this
that,
tool.
It's that sophisticated.
Yeah. Because of that short half-life, you don't have to worry too much about overdoing it.
Right.
It'll kick in if I give you an injection in the arm, you'll start noticing in about 3 to 5 minutes. And we'll know the peak level at around 12 to 14 minutes. So then if I see I want to bring a person a little deeper, I can bring them deeper. If I want to keep them in that level, because oftentimes most ketamine clinics don't do what my wife and I do, and that is what we call ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, where we're with the client during the during the ketamine treatment itself and guiding them in the process. That's very rare.
I have to tell you that as you're talking, I'm fascinated and terrified at the same time. And I'm really glad that you just said what you did, because it's so unimaginable that you would help somebody get into that state but not really understand what it is that you're bringing to the surface in the person. And that the amount of trauma that you could stimulate if you're not sophisticated and emotionally healed yourself, that you would not even see what it is that you're, it sounds like it could really harm somebody unless they are willing to consider doing it the way you do it, with just being really careful and mindful and understanding what it is that you're actually helping the person tap into.
I've actually treated a couple patients of mine who came to me after going to a ketamine clinic. And then what happened with them is that, so what I was describing before, where we might take a person a little bit lighter into the space, what they might call in psychedelic therapy, what we call, they call it a psycholytic dose, where the person still has full consciousness, they can talk, they haven't become like intoxicated, they can actually converse pretty well.
Okay.
But most clinics, what they do is they go right into what they would call a transformational dose, where basically you're conscious, but you're not even able to really moving or anything like that. So in those clinics, you not necessarily would get the ab reaction right in while getting the treatment. But what does happen is that ketamine improves, it has cognitive improving effects. So, it improves in particular episodic memory recall. So what you'll get is oftentimes, and I've had this happen, is that a person will undergo a treatment in one of these clinics where maybe it's run by an anesthesiologist or some other person in a specialty where they're running 6 rooms concurrently and just running people in and out, you know, high volume practice. Maybe they have a sitter there just in case something was going to go on, but no one really trained in that regard. But then they go home, and you know, ketamine's impact on improving neuroplasticity and memory recall. And then I've had like I think at least 3 patients where the day after they had these powerful de-repression of memories,
right?
And no therapist, no idea that why would this was happening. Wow. And literally had, you know, re-traumatized themselves, and thankfully they were able to find, you know, our clinic, and I'm sure other people have gone to find other doctors who are likewise doing it the way that my wife and I are doing it. And we were able to kind of, it's nice, we can actually bring them back into a similar experience,
right?
But then create an emotionally corrective one. And, yeah, and thankfully we were able to reverse that issue. But yes, possibility for damage is in particularly psychological damage is definitely there. And it's one of the cautions I have with the great growth ketamine clinics, especially ones that are doing it at home. People are taking like lozenges without being guided, and having no clue.
Super dangerous.
Very dangerous.
You know, Michael, if I can interrupt just for a second, also the part of it that's frightening to me is that oftentimes my experience with people that have been traumatized is that they freeze as a natural reaction to dealing with something that's too much for a person to be able to handle.
Correct.
So if you're using a drug that takes you into that frozen place,
yes,
and you're kind of stuck there and you can't really speak and talk about what it is that all it's going to do is just trigger that same overwhelming feeling of helplessness. And so, again, I am so glad we're having this conversation because people need to hear what the right way to do this treatment what the right way is to do it. Because mm-hmm. the more you're talking about it, the more I can, it's just like, if it's not done properly, it's going to hurt more than it's going to help.
It definitely can. I mean, like I said, if you go deep enough, and I think it's one of the reasons why we don't see it even more, is if you go deep enough, even when you get into that sort of frozen state, there's a intoxication and dimming of the mind. So you could think of it as someone being really severely drunk.
Oh, okay.
So
they're not as aware as I might think.
Exactly. So, okay. But there is like some people who just naturally are, maybe they just require more ketamine. So they get a standard dose, but they are in that now space. And okay. So that probably does happen where they're not so intoxicated that they definitely want to talk or shout, but can't. Uh-huh. So that I can almost imagine that is happening. I just think there's at least it's not as I think prevalent as it could be because of that other thing, you know, the other nature in which they are so intoxicated that they would have to actually have the wherewithal to want to even do that in that moment. But yes, I think it does probably happen, and I think it happens probably more frequently. And then people may not ever come out and want to even speak to any psychiatrist again or any other doctor again. Right. And they're probably suffering. And hopefully if they hear this is to understand that ketamine, I only recommend ketamine assisted psychotherapy. And it's not just because of my practice. I mean, we have enough patients to be quite honest with you. It's not something in that regard. It's just that that is the way as you see it, or anyone who understands, once they understand how it works, how important set and setting is in this regard, and having the appropriate psychotherapeutic foundation resourcefulness right next to you during this process is critical. And
How'd you come to this understanding? Is it just a natural way that you kind of see people that you can sense these things, or was this something that you studied to get to that place? How did you come to this deeper understanding of how to use ketamine?
Sure. I think that's multifactorial. I think it's one is that I've used as an herbalist, I've used many different compounds that can shift consciousness in different ways.
Right.
And so I became very familiar with the power of set and setting. And I've also been an explorer in this area myself and different area, you know, different compounds. I'm taking it and just noticing when I was putting myself in not the best environment when doing so, and then doing it another, and how powerful, you know, the best teacher is experience. It may be one of the hardest ones, but it's the best.
I was going to say, well, that's how we all learn the hard way, right?
Exactly. So there was that, but then also I got taught ketamine therapy by a gentleman, one of the most brilliant psychiatrists I've ever met, true Renaissance man, but Dr. Jeffrey Becker. And he has been involved with ketamine therapy for, I think now for close to like maybe 15, 17 years, like a long, long time he's been on that. And he was very adamant that, you do it with like as a psychotherapy guide or it's something that's also called CAT, ketamine assisted therapy. So that's what he had called it. But he was very much into doing it that you had to actually go through at least 20 guided experiences yourself.
So you know exactly what it feels like.
Before you would even touch a person.
Oh, okay.
So that you knew the space inside out. So at any time they would go into any space that might be challenging and difficult, you likely went somewhere close to that space yourself. And you could easily facilitate them during those experiences. So he had us go through that, and we went and got our own experiences through him and then other people like Terrence Early and other doctors. So both my wife got trained in this, and that's how we came to just know that that was super important dynamic. And you could just extrapolate that from any kind of very powerfully transformative conscious tool, that set and setting is going to be extremely important, and poor set and setting can create. I mean, I've treated a couple clients with psilocybin, which is becoming a lot more popular. I've treated two people legitimate PTSD, full on, not just like traumatic. I'm talking about the full PTSD diagnosis from a bad psilocybin trip because they were just in a really bad situation that was not helpful, and they took it. So these tools are extremely powerful. I mean, something that can rapidly change someone's suicidality in one treatment, or even and their depression in one treatment. And then we now see studies with psilocybin where, you know, one treatment and we're seeing increases in actual personality traits, like openness was still significantly open after one treatment 12 months later. So these compounds they make us more open. There is a greater vulnerability in that openness and to potentially adversive stimuli in your environment. So that's what came, I think the confluence of all of that really made it really just almost to me, it almost seems like common sense that would be the case. But, you know, I recognize that obviously without those experiences, how others might not see that as being common sense.
And this man that you learned from, has he written a book or anything that people could read in order to sort of get this on a deeper level?
Yeah, it's a good question. I know he wrote a chapter, MAPS, the multidisciplinary, I always forget this acronym, but it's the psychedelic studies. It's that organization that really started increasing our awareness of psychedelics like MDMA, psilocybin. So he wrote a chapter, I know, and part of the book on ketamine on that. But I'm not aware of any sort of book that you could get on like Amazon or something like that. But I'll keep that in the back of my mind. If I find something like that, I'll give it to email it to you. You could always link it up in the future to someone who might be interested in that, because I think that's a good question.
Because I think that this is really important. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So when you first meet someone, how do you evaluate whether you think ketamine might be useful as part of their treatment?
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I do 20-minute free consultations is one of the things that I saw for myself, so I could actually just also for people who do the integrative method. I mean, so some people are just used to, after being with doctors for a while, just wanting to get a diagnosis and get their medication. And so when I was first accept people just without the consult, and I'd often come across that. And so I really didn't want to become a med manager. That wasn't my interest. I really wanted to help facilitate true healing in people. And I always would say to my clients, my goal is that you don't need me anymore. I don't want you to need me. You know, if another stressor comes down the line, sure, I always have my door open to you, but I don't want you hanging out here. So I wanted to, start to screen out people in that regard. So I do these screenings, and at this point, given the safety profile of ketamine, my wife and I'll give you, like, my wife and I both said, we had a child and they were experiencing like severe depression. I can say like they were 16 years old, 15 years old, and we were trying even like lifestyle things and it wouldn't work. Our first go-to would be ketamine.
Even with an adolescent?
Yes, I would. I wouldn't hesitate, without like, if that's, they were 12 or older, I would be completely okay. Because ketamine has been used, its primary use was anesthetic was in pediatric anesthesiology.
Oh, really?
Okay. And at so 10 it's been times used the dose children. We use for psychotherapeutic work.
Okay.
So we're at a much lower dose. And that's why its safety profile is so tremendous that it's got the track record.
That is really important. Yeah. But why not with younger children?
You mean why don't they use it with like younger
children?
Yeah,
with younger children who've been, I see a fair number of people that actually did get help when they discovered, parents discovered that as a 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever, were really traumatized, especially sexually. Mm-hmm. They get help, with play therapy, but it's not long-term effective. It seems as though once you go through puberty, it's a whole nother a chapter of healing that is necessary, in my opinion.
Sure.
So I'm just out of a curiosity, is it ever used with young kids that have been traumatized?
The last time I looked at the clinical data, I know they were doing it in adolescents. I think, because of probably IRB or Internal Review Board qualifications, I'm not sure. And I'm not aware of any things done on earlier children. I mean, from my own sort of just empirical just review on the question, I don't see any reason why it couldn't be.
Okay.
I don't see, especially since a lot of doctors are giving antipsychotics to kids at like 5 or 6 years old, which we know is
not a good idea.
I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous is what it is. Because I just think we've just been so myopic in what we think is actually adequate treatment for mind health issues. And so I think that's one of the major problems. But I wouldn't, if I had a child who was doing that, I would probably be doing my own research. And I would likely, given I didn't find any red flags, if I was going to go into synthetic medicine treatment, it would probably be the first one I would use.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So going back now to your patient, the patients is that I often recommend it to most patients who often don't have what would be the kind of red flags that we wouldn't want to use ketamine for. If the person has a sort of proclivity towards psychosis, that would be something we want to deviate away from if they have a significant cardiac history, in which, because ketamine can stimulate the heart rate, usually about 50 beats per minute higher than baseline for about 30 minutes. And for most of us, that would be like jogging. But for some of us, if we were to jog in their history, that might be actually a problem. So for people of that, we would probably, you know, want them to either do some lifestyle management first and prepare their body for it before we would want to do it. Someone with respiratory conditions as well, we would have to be very careful about. But, you know, aside from those kind of things and, you know, their own sort of hesitancy, and also certain medications that we could always talk about, if you want, like if they're on high dose benzos or something like that, which would mitigate some of its impact, or if they're drinking a lot of alcohol, again, these things, we would want them to reduce it first and almost eliminate it before we would use it. But otherwise, I would be open to using it for almost most conditions. Cause like, if you have an augmenting hypnotic agent, I mean, that opens the door for almost any condition.
Right, right. Michael, what I'm thinking about is that with most psychedelics, the people I've spoken to, they don't want you to be on traditional pharmaceutical drugs because they, the people have told me that it's kind of contraindicated if you're using psilocybin or MDMA or LSD. Ketamine, not the same thing?
Nope. Well, the thing with the other three is that they all work on the serotonin receptor, the 5-HT2A to be specific. And so their concern is that oftentimes our antidepressants like SSRIs, like Prozac, they're increasing serotonin. So there's a theoretical risk in their regard about what we call serotonin syndrome, having serotonin, which can cause a problem. To be quite honest with you, I think it's a little bit overblown. I've had a lot of people that I know and personally have used these compounds in conjunction with that, again, but using known quantities, known things, not going overboard. I think where people probably would fall into that is if overuse or abuse of these compounds. I don't really think that's as big of an issue as people think make it out to be, but that's why you get those sort of more cautious warnings. But I'll tell you, from knowing a lot of people from the underground, as long as you're not on like really intense doses of those other medicines, they often are now being more open to using those kind of things, although traditionally that is true.
Okay.
They would often want to not mess around with that for those reasons.
And what about people that have had head injuries like concussions or strokes or... I've had a couple strokes. The second one that I had was really, really significant. I was completely paralyzed and unable to speak for a period of time. And then after I got out of the hospital, I couldn't stop crying.
Yeah.
And it was so awful because I kept saying that, you know, to the neurologist, like, what's wrong with me? I've never, you know, I'm not, I like to cry, but not every day. It was getting very annoying.
You're dehydrating yourself.
Right. And then I woke up one day and I thought, oh my God, I know what's going on. Mm-hmm. My neurotransmitters have gotten all messed up because of the brain injury I suffered. I tried Prozac and I tried Lexapro, but I couldn't handle the side effects. And I stumbled upon Effexor, and I take like a baby dose. I think the regular dose is like, what, 150 is a clinical dose?
Yeah, we use it 150, even up to 225.
Yeah, I'm taking 37 and a half.
Beautiful.
And it's a miracle. I mean, within a couple of weeks, when I came home, my wife said, oh my God, I got my husband back.
Yes.
And ever since that time, I'm terrified to go off of it because I can't even tell you how much it helped. And it's so often that I've had people come to see me that have had concussions and other, there's a fellow I'm working with right now that just had a benign brain tumor reboot, but his neurotransmitters have been really disrupted by that surgery. Do you use ketamine to help sort of boost the neurotransmitter part of people's brains, or is it not?
Absolutely. Yeah. Where I would say it's even even more important in the cases of, say, TBI, traumatic brain injury, concussions. I've actually had some really good results with that.
Have you?
Oh, yeah. I get goosebumps when I talk about it.
Oh, because that's amazing.
It's been amazing. Like, I had a couple cases where they've actually weren't better for over, like, 60 years and getting movement on that. Which was like, I was, you know, you're not sure, you know, after six years, it might have been, you know, there might be, because usually there's ancillary damage that accumulates. But seeing people really get a lot better, and I'm not saying it's a panacea, it may not work for everyone. And again, this is just reflecting from my own clinical experiences. But yeah, one of the main effects of ketamine that they right now is that it is a neuroplastic booster.
Okay.
So it generally will increase after the initial injection anywhere from 3 to 7 days. You get like, the way I like to describe it is like, it's like putting your nervous system into an 18-year-old nervous system. The way it can grow, the way it can blossom, and it's and how fast it can adapt and change its own structure, it makes you more highly adaptable, essentially, for this time period. Now, because you're open and adaptable, again, everyone thinks neuroplasticity, good, not true. Getting addicted to a substance is neuroplastic as well. It's growing, but in a maladaptive way. So one of the things I'm very careful to instruct my clients on as to how they spend their time when they're getting these ketamine sessions afterwards. What are they exposing themselves to? I would say don't watch like a lot of violent movies. Watch more things that you find, you know, helpful, creating a nourishing environment, because you're more suggestible. So that's going to impact you, and your brain is going to be changing. So you want to nourish that. Like it's like brain fertilizer, and now you now put it in the right environment to allow new, powerful, positive adaptive growth, rather than, you know, because one could then do the ketamine and then get into all kinds of fights and all that, and actually increase theoretically negative adaptive growth. So that's one of the main parts of it. So getting back to the concussion and TBI, you know, you have the cellular damage that needs to maybe can be corrected. Ketamine also has anti-inflammatory components. It decreases pain pretty quickly. It works indirectly with the mu opioid receptor system, so it and increases pain threshold. So a lot of people suffering from TBI and concussions often get very hypersensitive to stimuli, both the perceptual stimuli and pain stimuli, and oftentimes it can make that, you know, lower that significantly. And then what's interesting about ketamine is that, you know, the first dose is about 3 to 7 days. The second dose, it lasts for another 7 to 10 days. The third dose, it lasts for a couple of weeks. By the sixth dose, it's sometimes lasting over a month to 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So there's this interesting cumulative sort of tail of how long this after effect goes.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
That lasts, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I'm mesmerized by our conversation. I think it's wonderful.
And so what I love to do is I then use my supplemental aspect. So when I'm working with TBI or concussion people, I'll be adding different herbs, different supplements to augment that strategy. So it's things like liposomal curcumin or high dose fish oil, these kind of and what I've learned is over the last sort of 3 years, and I think this is what does separate our clinic away, is that I've learned a lot in how to combine what augments ketamine. This is the exciting part, like different compounds that tend to boost ketamine's
increase
effects.
Its effectiveness.
Because once you know its mechanisms of action, which is a many, it's a, what we call a promiscuous drug, but in a good way. So once you know those, then you can learn, well, what other supplements that would that pathway that it impacts, can we, you know, sort of foster that, nourish that? And oftentimes the answer to that question, at least empirically and looking at it, is yes.
Interesting. So
it's been very interesting.
Now, in my experience, about 25% of people that take, you know, serotonin or norepinephrine type antidepressants, it doesn't work.
Would you put it at 25?
25.
Oh, I would put it much higher than
that. Oh, you would?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well.
I would put it more close to at least 50.
Really?
Yeah.
So is ketamine, is it helpful with people?
No. Yeah.
I'm just really curious because some people are so desperate to get some relief when they know that a huge part of their suffering is, you know, biological brain chemistry related, but the medicine doesn't work or the side effects are so horrible that that it's, you know, intolerable. Mm-hmm. Ketamine helps in those situations?
It can. Yeah, it can. I don't want to say every situation because tool is 100%, right?
Yeah, we could tout this as a miracle, but it does sound like it's an amazing amazing tool in healing, that's for sure.
Absolutely. I'll give you some benchmark numbers, though, to help you kind of get an understanding. I would put that about a third of the patients respond. I'm not saying full remission from the depression with a classic antidepressant. But I put it at about a third, and I put it even less. I put it at a quarter after 12 months because you'll get it sometimes of what we call a poop out effect.
Right.
You know, a notorious Prozac does that. You know, I like Prozac, but it can do that.
Yes.
So you have that issue. So the, I lost my train of thought a little bit there.
Well, you were telling me about the percentages of the people that get help.
Perfect. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a Friday here. Brain starting to get a little fried.
You know what? If I'm not paying attention, I'm in big trouble.
So yeah, about a third will be, like I would say, significant responders. And I'd say about a quarter after 12 months. So we'll get generally after six treatments, if the person goes through just six treatments. The studies show about 70%.
Oh, that's a good percentage.
And when combined with psychotherapy, it reaches anywhere from 80 to 90%. Though I will say those studies are more case review studies, so right. We still need a little more right. data on that to confirm that. But I'll say from empirical...
Well, it makes sense, though.
Yes, exactly. Well, I'm just saying that on the numbers itself, even right. the other one. But yeah, I would say that maybe around 80%.
Okay.
We'll get at least significant reduction in which we can get control over, like if they're... Because generally when people are coming to see us, especially we're out of network, they've usually seen about a couple psychiatrists.
I was going
to
say.
They've seen a lot of therapists. We're getting some of the toughest of the toughest.
Yes, I can imagine
that. So, but we're getting... I would say we see at least where the... If you would ask the patient, would you... are you glad you went through the sessions or not? Did you feel like they were helpful? Guess that at least 80-85% would say yes to that question.
And one person that I know that went through the treatment also was prescribed a pen that, you know, that they would, is it like a pen cartridge, like you would inhale it? Is that like a very tiny dose to supplement the...
Oh, okay.
I'm not using the right word. I'm sorry, but...
It's okay. There's many different forms. There's a nasal spray.
Oh, okay.
That they use oftentimes you can get compounded. They also have one that's through the pharmaceutical companies too, but you can get it compounded as well if you want to bypass that. But there's sublingual forms as well, taking it underneath the tongue. And that. So those are the ways that I'm familiar with. I'm not familiar if there was like a... Because generally you're not really want to give a person an injection.
It's not an injection. It's more of like a vape pen. They call them pens for whatever
reason.
Interesting, yeah. So what would be the purpose of supplementing a tiny dose of ketamine after the treatments?
Mm-hmm. I generally don't do that. I'm not against it though, but it's just not something I have as much experience with. Because I want them to focus on the lifestyle factors afterwards, like really focus on that. Though I might introduce that at a little later time, but it does add a level of complication to the treatment. I'm doing usually a lot of other treatments as well, so I didn't want to, but to give you an answer to that, because I do know other people who do that, is that one could be cost, because when you're coming in and doing a full-on session, you know, it does cost. I mean, we are physicians and we don't charge anything for the ketamine. We simply charge for our time. But oftentimes we're doing 2.5-3 hour sessions with an out-of-network physician, which could be costly. So oftentimes some doctors will augment that, giving maybe not as big of a dose, but like a medium-sized dose. Once the patient has gotten to learn the ketamine, how to use it, and you can get this boost, this boost in neuroplasticity, which can translate into an energetic boost, sometimes pretty quickly. And then they can use that to kind of like boost them. Like, let's say they can't do it every week for a while. They will do it maybe every 3 weeks and maybe put a little booster in between.
Michael, is there anything that I'm forgetting to ask you about ketamine that I should?
Well,
we haven't spoken about yet.
There are so much I could fill that question with. I think I could probably talk for it for hours on end, but just off the cuff to seeing if there's any other. I just think one thing is just be to the audience, because obviously they might get more interested hearing this conversation.
Oh, and absolutely.
That is, I think maybe we can talk about, you know, the rapid growth of ketamine clinics and what one would want to probably be mindful of when they're evaluating whether this type of clinic or what I should do on that. So, you know, I don't think it's a game changer if the person is not a psychiatrist. I think it is better that the person who is administering is a psychiatrist. I probably have a bias there. But the thing is that they can better assess suicidality, especially if you're going in for those type of like more urgent matters.
Sure.
But if they at least have, if they themselves are not a psychiatrist, and it's usually then an anesthesiologist, often ER docs too, that at least they have psychotherapists with them that can do post-integration work. Because oftentimes if they're anesthesiologists, ER docs, they're not going to play around with the dose. They're going to actually probably put the highest end dose on them. So the actual ketamine experience, it's not going to be as important, but right afterwards when they stop popping out, like there's another clinic nearby that works this way, which I think is a very valid model, where the person then afterwards would get up, and then when they come to, which is actually pretty quick, usually around 2 hours, they can then they have a post-integration session with a therapist.
Oh, okay.
And that's another model that I would say where you can get a little cheaper.
Sure.
Because it's not with the doctor all the time. If the person's looking for that, that would be another acceptable model in my mind.
Okay.
How ketamine could be run. Also, I would also recommend if anyone has any idea that they have any significant trauma in their life, that ketamine can improve and often does improve are what's called episodic memory recall, your ability to recall old memories. And sometimes they can come in extremely vividly.
Right.
And you may not even be aware of, like, you all of a sudden the memory when you were 6 years old,
right,
you had no idea. So just understanding that, and you would want to have a therapist who's trauma-based
right
with you. If you have any idea whether that, like, if you're conscious of that, or you just have a some sort of intuitive inkling that you might, I would say you should get a therapist regardless of that, just that, because it will enhance the results. You're going to invest a decent amount of money no matter what, which one you go to. So you might as well make the most of it. And that's one thing I would highlight is that they do that, that they've had the training, where they've had training from. Mm-hmm. That's another one, because some of these clinics are run by people who have received no training whatsoever.
Right.
They just started doing that. And how they, you know, like how they do the sessions, what's the set and setting, whether they can have someone in the room with them if they wanted to do that or not, whether, like, who's sitting in the room. Is it just one sitter with six people to look at, as opposed to having some other people? What's their training in this? You know, those are really important questions. But fundamentally, I would definitely say have a good therapist with you before embarking on it, for many reasons, but to get the most juice out of this. Really important therapy.
Yes, I'm going to reiterate to everybody listening to this podcast that this information is extremely valuable and necessary, because as we're talking, I can see the benefit is huge, but it really scares me to imagine it under the untrained and money-making, you know, under those kind of environments, because that's going to cause more damage than anything.
Yeah, and I believe there's probably a lot of people who've gone into ketamine therapy, had horrifying experiences, may have never decided to trust any other psychiatrist or other doctors again, and possibly miss out on the modality that actually could have really helped them the most. And that's really sad.
Yes, that is really sad, yes. I mean, again, you know, once you practice for a while, I usually see people that have been to multiple therapists before they're finding their way to me.
Yeah.
A lot of them have been helped. I'm not saying that it hasn't been useful. But when you start to go into the deeper levels of your consciousness and deal with the trauma, I do a lot of hypnosis with people. Mm-hmm. It's such a vast difference in terms of the healing potential than if it's just, you know, sort of talk therapy.
Oh, so, absolutely. I generally say to people who are interested in psychotherapy, the first question I would say, ask them if they've ever done depth psychotherapy themselves.
Exactly.
They don't have to give you specific, but they should tell you that answer. And if they don't, I say walk away.
Right.
There's no way that a person can be good. They will definitely project their own shit onto you
without question,
without them knowing. So that's for sure. Numero uno. And two is that, like, for me, it took me I'll usually give my own little self-divulgence. It took me five therapists before I found the sixth one, in which then I did three years of depth work with. So I said, you give it like five or six sessions. If you're not feeling a trend towards a kind of convergence in the therapeutic alliance, I think you can then let that person go and move on to the next person. But you're not looking for just a friendly face and an ear. You're actually looking for someone who's going to really help you therapeutically.
Yeah, develop a relationship with
you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Michael, do you have a website that you would like to put out there so people can get some information?
Yeah, I'm going to be transitioning, so right now I'm not adding new content, but there's plenty of articles that I've written on different mind health topics at drmantz.com, drmantz.com.
Okay.
And I'm also on Twitter.
Oh, good.
I tend to be on Twitter, so it's I think it's at Michael Mance MD on Twitter as well. So I'll do that like three or four times a week and give out some things on ketamine, some things on general commentary, and some of my Jersey humor come out there. So
That's good too, though. If you don't have humor, then nobody's going to want to come see you anyway. So I think it's really important to be able to first laugh at ourselves and then you know, make things not always 100% serious, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And then the one last thing I didn't want to forget, I'm also working with Dr. Elizabeth Wolfson. We're going to be starting our first ketamine retreat in Santa Barbara.
So how will that work?
It's going to be in October. We're going to finalize the details, but it's going to be a 1.5-day retreat designed for health professionals.
Wow.
You know, those of us who are on basically the front lines working with whether in the mental health or otherwise, and just burned out and really needing to just come with, like, we're going to keep it small. 6-piece slots are going to open up, and I'm putting my toe in this new pool, which I'm really excited about, and how to use a group ketamine therapy in that regard, and how to use that together and then do group processing afterwards. So I'm really excited about that. Oh, I think that's wonderful. So that'll be available in October. So if people would want to be, they could always notify me through the website or through Twitter if they want to be on a mailing list of sorts, and that way I could put you on the mail and just let you know about the retreat when we get at that finalized. And I'm sure we'll be doing other exciting things with ketamine in the future. So
I will say that maybe 10 years ago or so, I had a group therapy as part of my practice for, I don't know, maybe at least a decade. Mm-hmm. And it was based on 6 people doing hypnosis together.
Beautiful.
And tapping into each other's consciousness in a certain way that was just stunningly amazing.
A mind meld.
It was really wonderful.
Wonderful.
Because somebody would choose to be the person that everybody would focus on. Mm-hmm. And it would be so much easier to deal with the deepest trauma when you felt accompanied by people that really cared about you.
Oh yeah.
It's like, was wonderful. So this is going to be amazing.
Yeah, I love it. Well, it's recapitulating like what we were in tribes, and mm-hmm. when we would have very powerful, whether there's grief, we grieve together.
Yeah.
And that's an important component.
Absolutely.
So, beautiful.
Well, Michael, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm going to bug you to come back on the show.
I hope so.
Because I really do appreciate your perspective. It's really been a pleasure. And I think that this information is absolutely worth its weight in not just gold, but platinum.
Well, so, I appreciate you, Dana, very much. And I'm really appreciative that you're doing this podcast. And I think it's helping because, you know, as we're in a big mental health crisis. And absolutely. That is not just blowing out like ever there's a crack, but legitimately, I can tell you, especially since the lockdowns and everything like that, and the amount of isolation that things like what you're doing, I deeply appreciate. And anytime I can have the free time to come help you out in that regard, I appreciate, and helping me out, I really appreciate the work that you're doing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.